Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
And now, acting legend Jeremy Irons, good morning to you in the Cork studio.
Good morning.
How are you, Jeremy?
Brendan, I'm very well. Very pleased to be talking to you. And, yeah.
And you're in Cork because your new film, Palestine 36, had its Irish premiere at the Cork International Film Festival this week. It's a powerful film. I believe the only movie filmed in Palestine in the last 2 years. Tell us a bit about it first.
Well, we were to have shot it about 3 years ago. It's about Palestine in 1936, the English mandate and the way we messed up so badly. But, of course, 2 years ago, the Israeli-Palestine war, I suppose you have to call it, blew up. And so we weren't able to shoot in the West Bank and we had to regroup and eventually we filmed the bulk of the film in Jordan, and they managed right at the end to get into Palestine and to do various shots which they had to have for the film. I met Anne-Marie Jassier, who is the director. I was a jury of the Berlin Film Festival, and she was on the jury. And Sinead and I got to know her, liked her very much, and woman of great passion. And she talked about this film, and she said, I have this film I'm trying to get made. Not easy, of course. Palestine doesn't have much of a film industry, and she was not able to. She lives in Bethlehem, but she was not able to be there. But I could hear the passion in her voice. And I said, well, listen, if it's any help, I'd love to, if there's anything for me, to play in it. And there was indeed an English sort of diplomat and military man, Warchip, who was there in 36, and she asked me to play him. And eventually, when they regrouped and got the money together to film in Jordan, I was out there for, I suppose, about 3 weeks. It's a very small role I play, only about three or four scenes, I think. But I was delighted to be able to sort of support the film and help the film. And when I saw it the other night in London, I was blown away by its power. You know, I think we hear, especially Ireland, who are such wonderful supporters of the state of Palestine, well, if you can call it a state, it's not really. But I felt it's in the news every day. We're appalled by what we see. But do we know the history? If we know the history, I think it all makes more sense. It doesn't stop the awfulness of it, but it, at least historically, we can understand how we got to where we've got to.
Yeah. The film deals with a slightly different aspect of the Palestine story. As you say, the focus is on the British colonialism, which is, it's really interesting. The colonialists we meet, right, there seem to be three types of guys. There's one guy who really buys into it and kind of thinks these people are animals, probably using it as a cover for his own brutality. There's one guy who has a conscience and objects to it all.
Yeah.
And then your character, the High Commissioner, he's interesting because, Jeremy, he seems to think he's a good man, does he? Almost feels like he's fulfilling some kind of responsibility to the people he's colonising?
I think so. I think so. And, of course, you know, there were good men who were colonisers. There were good men in India. There were certainly... I think that's one of the strengths. It's not black and white.
No.
You know, it's like there are many wonderful Israelis who are appalled by what their government are doing at the moment. There are wonderful Palestinians. The problem is that the extremists, Hamas, I think could be seen as having an extreme arm anyway, and some of the Israeli extremists, and indeed in the past English extremists, they're the ones who tar everybody. But it's very important that we understand that not everybody is malevolent.
Yeah.
But I think many Israelis, many Palestinians are appalled by what their so-called representatives are doing. And
yeah.
I wanted to play Warchop as a man, a reasonable man, which I think he was. He was trying to sort it out. And we know with politics and with international relations, it's often the hardest thing to do. I mean, look at Ukraine now.
You see, we don't tend to see in history the grey areas and people caught up in history. Like, so you think of Warship. You must have thought while you were playing him, do you think you'd be capable of doing the things that he did if you were in the wrong circumstances? Would any of us?
I don't know. I think I would have tried. I probably would have done no better than him. I think most people are reasonable and try and sort things out in a humanitarian, humane way. But it still seems to internationally get us in a terrible state. You know, I mean, I think Zelensky is doing wonderful work in Ukraine, holding the country together. And I think he's a reasonable man. But, you know, what do you do? History shows us that. And history often gets it wrong because the winners write the history.
Mm.
But I think the English legacy in Palestine is something we should be very ashamed of. We were just, you know, the English sort of think you can draw on a map and say that's the country. Of course you can't, because people who lived there have lived there for generations and they can't suddenly be booted out. So I don't know what the answer is, really.
You said something once that always stuck with me. I don't know where you said it. It was years ago. But you said your education, which was in a very posh private school, was basically aimed at creating guys who would do well in the colonies.
Yeah.
So what kind of person did schools like yours aim to churn out?
Well, people who could have a stiff upper lip, who could deal with trouble, who could not get over emotional and who were sort of a bit cut off from their emotions. I mean, I boarded at school from the age of 7. And it's very interesting. You create a personality that copes with being sort of in the jungle, which is what you are with boys of that age. You don't have any parental or maternal comfort when you're in such a situation. You have to cope. And you create, I think, a sort of carapace, which is, of course, very useful as you grow up and you come to maturity, and you can then go off to other countries knowing that you're somehow superior.
Yes. Yes.
and deal with people very different from you, and sort of you put them on a different level. It's appalling, but it's what we did for 200 years anyway.
Yeah, but still we're doing it up to the time that you were in school. Is it hard then to break out of that system? Because you obviously did and became an actor and everything. Is that difficult, though? Is there a tug, like, if you've been brought up and socialised in it?
No, I always kicked against it. I would break a lot of rules very quietly. I mean, I sort of have always believed that rules are to be broken. They're there to stop things getting appalling, but you can actually cope with not doing what you're supposed to be doing and not harm anybody else. And that's sort of always been my route. And somehow I was attracted to being a rogue and a vagabond, which is what we are as actors. We're sort of, well, historically, we were outside society. We didn't have the rights that many people had. We weren't a profession. And that's always, I've always quite liked that aspect of it. So I fought against this at school. And then I suppose going to drama school and beginning to get in touch with my emotions got me even further away from that sort of illness, which I think boarding education gives you. I think it cuts you off from your... I look at some of my contemporaries who went through that route, and I think you're completely cut off from your emotions. You don't know where they are.
Good God, that's kind of brutal, isn't it?
I think it is. Did
you keep up with those guys from school? Like, I assume they all went and worked in the city and in the civil service and the upper echelons and stuff, did they?
And the military.
Yeah.
Yes, I sometimes come across them and I'm sort of appalled.
So they were brutalised themselves as well, really, in a way.
Yeah.
Emotionally, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one of the great things about... we used to have these great sort of wooden bins, sort of rubbish bins, in our main living area, and all rubbish would go in there. And as a new boy, you would be put in the bottom, and a lot of boys would sit on the top of you and then on the lid. And you were sort of squashed down there, and it was all part of breaking your individual will, I think. So you have to be a team player and play the game, and I wasn't too keen on that. So anyway, yes, drama school got rid of it, and of course marrying an Irish woman, you know, gets you rid of it. I knew I needed to get away from the Anglo-Saxons and was very pleased to marry a Celt. And I think now I've probably lost all vestiges that I had in those early days when I was at boarding school. Of course, a lot of Irish went to boarding school too.
Yeah, 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 they did. Do you work less these days? Are you choosing your roles more selectively? Like, as you say, you did this very strategically. It was a small enough amount of work, but it gave your imprimatur and your presence and your star quality to an important film. So are you choosing more selectively now?
I am. I'm trying to retire, really. But every now and again, people offer me something which, for one reason or other, either because of the subject matter or because I'll be earning shedloads of money if I did it, that I do go back. I've just finished a Jason Statham movie called Beekeeper 2. I did Beekeeper 1, and this is Beekeeper 2. And that's... a kickbollock and scramble movie. It's great, you know, it's wonderful, but it hardly draws on whatever depth I have as an actor. But it was fun. So I do.
And do you still need cash coming in, do you?
Not really. But, you know, I don't think it's too good to retire completely.
No.
You always hear about people who retire and then 10 months later they're dead, you know. So I like to have, you know, I've got a few things I have to do, small things, but I'm going to go off and make a movie again in January, I think it is. And it's nice to have that to think about and, you know, you keep yourself fit and...
Yeah.
So I think probably I shall just potter on making movies.
I'm enjoying your character of Martin Levy, who plays... It's Jennifer Aniston's character's father in the morning show on Apple TV. Did you enjoy doing that?
I did quite. It was too far away. We have to shoot in Los Angeles, and so that means an awful lot of flying backwards and forwards. But yeah, they're a lovely bunch, and I think it's quite well written and quite well made.
It's a good show, yeah.
Yeah.
How did you get on with Jennifer Aniston?
Oh, very well. Yeah, she's a cracker. She's a cracker, and she was very pleased I was doing it. So we had it's a show run by women, really. It's a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Reese and she are the producers, and the showrunners are women, and the writers are women. So one is surrounded by women, which is, you know, never a difficult thing.
Where else would you want to be?
Right.
Do you have to make peace at some stage with the fact that at this stage of things, you're now playing Jennifer Aniston's dad and not her lover?
Peace. Yeah, I sort of made that, you know, when I disappeared and for 6 years to do up the castle. I knew I was then about sort of 50 odd.
Yeah.
And I knew things were going to change because of my age. So I sort of did something else for those 6 years. And then when I came back, the father, so to speak. And that's fine. That happens to all of us.
Okay, so you went off quietly, went through the change, the metamorphosis, and came back kind of ready for,
yeah,
like, sexless roles,
yeah,
we call them.
Yeah.
Because you always radiated a certain sexual energy, didn't you? And you played a lot of overtly sexual roles. Is it hard then, you hit a certain age and suddenly it's sexless roles?
No, I never find anything sexless.
Really?
I don't know. I think... yeah, you don't stop... certainly, you don't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the chemistry between... still happens. But it's just be slowing down is probably quite a good thing.
But you still bring the kind of libido in the broadest sense, that life force, the kind of vaguely sexual energy into everything. It has to be there, does it?
Well, I'm not really conscious of it. If it's there, it's because it's me. But, I mean, you know, things change as you get older. But you're still very attracted to people. So I suppose, you know, that probably comes over in cinema in some way.
Yeah, that energy.
Mm.
Levy in the Morning Show as well is a fairly self-serving man. I mean, I think we call everyone a narcissist now, but he's the type we tend to call a narcissist now.
Right.
What kind of a father are you?
Oh, I'm not very good. I'm not very good. I mean, I remember the doctor when Sinead gave birth to Sam, my eldest son, and he said, "Now listen, that child isn't yours. It's just with you for a while, but it's his own person, and you've got to protect it and guide it. But it'll never be you. It might think very differently from the way you think." But nevertheless, it's your duty to look after it for sort of 15, 16, 17 years. And I've always had that feeling with my children. I've tried to impress on them that probably the most important thing in life is to discover what makes you happy and follow that. Not what makes you famous or makes you rich or whatever, just what makes you happy. And I think both my boys have found that, which I'm very happy about. But I was a pretty free-range father, I think. They were on a long lead, if they were on a lead at all. I think Sinead's a much better mother than I was a father.
You see, of course, it sounds like you were a great father, though.
Well, I don't know. I was away an awful lot filming.
It probably wasn't the worst thing either, was it?
Well, probably not. Probably not.
Are you a grandfather now? Because I know a lot of people who were kind of free-range fathers. They get this whole new lease of life with the grandparenting and get right in there and they love it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I am a grandparent of... Max has a daughter. He's 2.5 now, and Sam has 2 sons. But once again, Sinead is a much better grandmother than I am a grandfather. I'm much more hands-off, but she's sort of obsessed by them. Fortunately for them, they live far enough away that, you know, we can't get at them the whole time. But I think back to how I was with my grandfather and grandmother.
Yeah.
You know, they were a completely different sort of people to how I felt.
So what, would they have been Victorians?
No, they weren't Victorian. They were sort of, I suppose, brought up in the 20s and 30s, went through the First World War as children, and then the Second World War, and some of them, my grandmother lost her first husband. And then remarried. But so, you know, it was very different to how things were in the 50s. When they were in England, they were pretty tough, but it was getting better. And then, of course, the 60s came and we thought we'd all died and gone to heaven because things really became wonderful.
Yeah.
Which showed in the music and the fashion and all of that. And people began earning sort of better wages. And I mean, sort of like Ireland in the 90s, you know?
Yeah.
When it began to really perk up towards the tiger.
Yeah, and look how that ended. Of course,
people
thought then this stability came in the world, they thought that would be forever, and of course we realise now that was a blip in history, Jeremy, wasn't it, really? Yeah. Listen, another interesting project you're doing. You are doing the voice of the sea, am I right, in an upcoming film, Water People, The Story of Us.
What is
that going to sound like? I know the sea, you're very connected to the sea. How will you channel the sea?
I have no idea. I haven't seen the script yet. I've done photographs with the director about 5 years ago, I think, and now she was going to write a book and now she's making a film. And I don't know, I suppose I'll sort of... Will I burble? Or bubble, maybe that, I don't know how the voice will be.
I think charming but menacing, though, it's kind of your thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That the sea is pretty much charming but menacing, isn't
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yesterday there was a lot of wind, and I think we've got a lot of wind coming. And yes, it's something to be respected.
Yeah.
The sea.
So do you get out sailing a lot? You do?
I don't get sailing as much as I should. I have my boat there, and I look at it and I think, I've only been out on you four times this year, which is sort of terrible. But
so have you bought a rib?
I do have a rib. I think I have one of the oldest ribs, if not the oldest rib, in West Cork.
OK, you were early in on the ribs, yeah?
Yeah, it's 35 years old, and I keep not wanting to get another. I'm actually looking at a boat that is not a rib, but that's just a nice sort of fishing boat.
And you get into the sea as well, do you? You swim?
I do, but once again, Sinead's much more into that. She loves cold water swimming, as do a lot of our guests. And because we're in Head of a Bay called Roaring Water Bay, which is relatively shallow, it's beautifully warm for about 4 months of the year. So we swim off the castle and love it.
Sounds divine.
Yeah.
How else do you entertain yourself down there?
We play music. We have a little island with some horses on it. And I mean, it's different now. It's, you know, now I'm older and it's all done. I don't have to do all this physical stuff, which I used to do. It's now, you know, getting up the stairs is probably the challenge of my day, whereas building them before was...
Is it a windy stone stair?
No, it's not windy. It's earlier. Windy came about 20 years, 30 years after Kilco was built. And so we've got an intramural staircase, which is straight. They're all straight inside the walls. Steep, but straight. 11-inch lifts on each of the steps.
I hope you have a banister, do you?
We do have a banister.
Okay, yeah.
We do have a banister. And I remember...
And you'll be getting in the chairlift now in the next few years.
Well,
they can put those things in everywhere
I'm thinking now. About it, absolutely. But we had the Leavis sisters, Nell and Julia from Ballydehob. They had a pub there. They were in their 90s and they would come to sessions we'd have at the castle. And they'd climb up on their hands and knees and climb down backwards on their hands and knees to get up. So they are 90. I can, you know, we didn't have a stair lift for them. I can cope with that.
Yeah, I gather the time to get in a stair lift is when there's a fall or something. You take that crisis as an opportunity and your children will then go, time for the stair lift, Jeremy.
Yes.
So would you still have sessions in the castle?
Yeah. Well, actually, we've got one tomorrow night.
And how many people would come?
We've got about, I think there's 9 musicians from outside and we have 3 musicians staying and me. So, yeah, we'll have... We'll have a fair and one dancer who'll probably come and dance away as we're playing. So it's...
And will you have guests in then to see it? Or
no, no,
people
no.
Who are all there or
no,
just
no,
the people
no.
involved?
People
it's
involved.
Just for yourselves?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. You fiddle, do you?
I fiddle. Well, I actually, since COVID, I big fiddle. I viola. And... Because I've fallen in love with that slightly deeper sound. It's a fifth lower than a fiddle.
Okay. And it fits in with Irish music, does it?
It does, although we play a lot of music that's not Irish. I mean, it's not all diddly-diddly-dee. Okay. I mean, Irish music is, you know, you only have to look at some of the great players. It's morphing, it's changing.
Yeah.
And that's what I love. I mean, when I learned Irish fiddle with Cuivín O'Reilly, and I realised that Irish music can be jazz. You know, it doesn't just have to be the diddly dee. It can be. You can play around with it. Music is sort of never ending in its way. It can be changed and morphed into something else.
The gloaming, being the classic example of that, of how they kind of put it through some kind of a spooky grinder there and turned it into this whole other kind of feel, didn't they?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to, you know, to give things life. I think they can't be... Music can't be stuck in a sort of jelly, you know. It has to be able to change and reflect the people who are playing it now. I was at a session night before last, very, very traditional, but nevertheless
Where?
I was up the coast in Kerry.
Yeah.
But that was very traditional, but I still quietly played my sort of jazz around it, which gave me pleasure. I'm not sure about anybody else.
I like it. the Oscar-winning Hollywood actor arrives in and joins the session and starts quietly playing jazz along. And who is going to say anything to Jeremy Irons? They're just glad you're there. Isn't it great?
I do ask people who I can trust. I say, you know, was that absolutely appalling what I was doing? Yeah. And they said, no, it's fine. You can't really hear it, which is probably a good thing.
Okay, so you have some people who will tell you the truth.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
You two are mortal, they whisper in your ear.
Very important to have that. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. Tell me, is there drink taken at these sessions? Are you still able to?
Yeah, well,
lash?
Actually, that session, because it was a bit of a drive to get up there, and I was the designated driver, I was drinking tea. So I was fine. But there normally is, yes, a little drink taken, which is nice.
Yeah. So you still have a bit of. A bit of wildness and madness in you, do you?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope that'll never go.
Yeah.
I'd be pretty boring without it.
By the way, did you notice that just last week, according to GQ magazine, you are currently one of the 50 most stylish people alive?
50? 5-0?
Yeah, 5-0. You're in there with Justin Bieber. Uh-oh. You know who that is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Zoe Kravitz, you know who she is, of course. Nick Cave, a very very kind of dapper but gothic. Sure. Tyler, the Creator's in there.
Oh,
yeah.
Lovely.
And then you. How would you characterise your style?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, over my lifetime, I've bought clothes that I enjoy, that I like, and I never throw anything out. So, I don't know what my... I always think that clothes should sort of... work with you and for you.
Yes.
I'm fortunate because I'm quite tall and slim. I can look quite well in.
You see, you can wear anything.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's nothing really to do with me, except I like to shock a little bit, you know, throw a bit of a curveball.
Yes. Will I tell you how they characterise your style?
Well, all right.
Eccentric. Septuagenarian, that's a bit catty. I feel they could have done without septuagenarian.
Yeah, absolutely.
Eccentric, septuagenarian, thespian style. Now, I'm not sure about this bit. This means, they say, jaunty hats. I don't think you're jaunty. I think you're cooler than jaunty. Jauntier scarves, but I like this bit, artisanal layering like his life depends on it. You kind of are an artisanal layerer, aren't you? Your whole life really is about artisanal layering.
I thought artesian were wells. You had artesian wells.
Yeah, but I think they mean artisanal in the sense of clothing that is kind of, you know, made by makers and that is not, you know, plastic from some factory in China. And
you are
layering it up like the patina of time onto you. And,
Oh, well, that's... all right, isn't it?
Yeah. By the way, the film, the Palestine 36 film, it's a very tragic and brutal film, right?
Yeah.
But it's somehow very beautiful as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The light and the textures and the landscape and everything.
Yeah, and the wonderful way she's hand-tinted the stock footage, the historical...
It's phenomenal, isn't it?
It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
And you hardly notice... But it's of course part of the story, and you know, nowadays we can't afford shots of a couple of thousand soldiers driving all those old vehicles. I mean, you can't if you're a Palestinian filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I think she's knitted it in really well.
It gave it an epic kind of quality, didn't it?
And of course, it's a personal story. You know, I mean, you're seeing these people. Going through what they're going through, and it's horrendous.
Yeah.
It's horrendous, and hardly any Israelis in it, strangely enough. You just see them sort of gently moving in on your land in the background, but it's...
Yeah, but again, a grey area, because we're also aware what they are fleeing as well. So again, it's kind of that, isn't it?
Yeah, like
it's,
yeah,
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 but they're just there settling away in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful.
I think that's the strength of the film, that it doesn't come down actually that hard on anybody, but it makes you understand what happened and it makes you care.
Yeah.
So I hope it'll do well. And
just going back to what you said there about that, it doesn't kind of beat you over the head with any opinions on it in a way, and it's just what happened and everything.
Yeah.
But it is kind of, part of it is a thing, I think, that you have, you've always been interested in exploring the kind of, I won't call it the shadow side, the more complicated, knotty side of humanity, haven't you? And that's kind of this again, isn't it?
Yes.
Is that what you're drawn to?
I think so. I think I love characters who are not black and white, but sort of grey, and can allow the audience time to understand and that sort of person, and be interested in what makes them tick. And the same with historical moments in life. I think it's very interesting. We're surrounded by a life which is, I suppose, led by the internet, probably, of black and white.
Yeah.
People think this, or they think the opposite, that, and they all print stuff against each other. And life isn't like that. I think to see the complexity of Palestine 36 is something I'm very glad to be part of.
Yeah. Do you think we're all less nice and less simple than we let on to other people?
Less nice? No, I don't. I think we're actually nicer.
Really?
Than what we let on. I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, on the net, it's always the people with the stupidest views and the loudest voices who get their messages on. But I think most people are really darling and do their best, often in very difficult circumstances. But the shouters, the people who, you know, like to make a fuss and not have their name in print so it's anonymous, they seem to get the news. And I think it's important that the media remind us that that's a tiny minority of our civilization. You know, it's maybe 0.1 or 0.5 or 0.005% of our population. It's not what most people are.
Jeremy, it's been terrific talking to you. Before you go, what are your priorities now at 77? What's important? Because I feel you'd have a clearer view on what's important than I do at this stage in life.
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I mean, of course, friends and family. I think I work harder on friendships now.
Yeah.
I was always very, very lazy on friendships. I was used to getting very close to people when I was working with them, and then you will go on to other jobs and you lose touch. And so I think I nurture friendship much more. Human relationships, I think, are the most important thing. And peace, you know, being able to sit and be peaceful. And whether you do that just as I do, sitting under a tree on an island, just staring, just lost in my thoughts.
Can you do that? Yeah.
I can.
You're at rest.
Yeah.
You're not tormented or full of angst or anything.
No, no.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and also I think learning that old adage, you know, learning what you can change and what you can't change in life, and working towards those things you can change, whether it's visiting neighbours or, you know, volunteering for something or whatever, just that gives you something back and which helps society. That's my phone.
Okay.
Can you hear it?
Yeah. Okay. Listen, I've kept you too long.
Great Palestine, talking to you, Brendan.
Yeah, you too. You too, Jeremy. Thank you so much. Palestine 36 is in the Arc Cinema in Cork tonight, tomorrow night and Monday as part of the Cork International Film Festival. It's also showing at selected cinemas nationwide. And Jeremy Ahrens, I know you had somebody arranged to give you a call there at a particular time, like someone trying to get out of a bad date.
That's
ring
right.
me up. in. Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me too, Brendan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.